You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Richard M. Schickel. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Richard, we spoke, maybe it was over a year ago when your first book came out, IRS Whistleblower. My 33 years as an IRS insider will show you the secrets of how to engage the IRS and win. And that book did very well, and it's still for sale, and people are really loving it because you really put a personal face on the IRS, and I had such a great time reading the book and doing the interview with you, and now you came out with another book, What to Do When the IRS is After You, Secrets of the IRS as Revealed by Retired IRS Employees. Richard, I want to get into that in great detail in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, and there are some people who are going to be a bit familiar with you, but for those who aren't, if you could give them a little bit of background about who you are and how you got to this point where you're at.
I was an IRS revenue officer, which is a tax collector, for 33 years, and I ended up as a senior officer for Southern Arizona. And I retired almost 3 years ago, and I kind of looked around and I was sick about how the tax system works. It's not equal for people. And I decided to write the first book. And then after the first book, the second book came out too, after I talked to other retired IRS people who wanted to help, because the whole system is such a mess, but it does seem to prosecute people that are just trying to follow the law. So that's why we wrote the second book also.
Right. So the first book was just you, and here you got a couple of people in this book. And this is kind of like a manual, like it says, What to Do When the IRS Comes After You. And the book actually teaches folks how to handle themselves in front of the IRS, how to actually represent themselves if they get audited, up to a certain degree. And you say here that the first sign, I guess the only sign, nowadays there are a lot of people getting scammed by phone calls from the IRS, and of course the IRS wouldn't call you. They would send the letter out. That's the first step.
Right.
Okay. And a lot of people actually, they don't even open up the letter, and they're afraid to. They actually might sit on it, as you say in the book, for a while and hope it goes away, but that's not going to happen.
Right. You know, unfortunately. Yeah.
So someone who got a letter from the IRS, I'm sure there's going to be some people who are listening to this interview who have gotten the letter from the IRS. How should they handle it?
Well, you have to open it. And if it's certified mail, you usually get some appeal rights. So the only thing to fear is if you don't open the letter. If you open the letter, then you can look to my book, look to many sources to figure out where am I at with the IRS. And then that's the important thing, to grab the bull by its horns, not let the IRS take charge of you and come in, because that's what they do. The IRS always thinks that you're trying to avoid audits, avoid paying taxes. And what you want to do is jump right on it and figure out how you can fit into the system and respond to your advantage and not to the IRS's advantage.
Okay. I don't know what's the normal time that the IRS gives you to reply to a letter, but if somebody's already gotten a letter, does it make sense for them to first grab the book, read the book, and then take it from there?
That would be a good thing, and the book is really helpful. One of the things we talk about in the book is to look it up on the computer. You can go into irs.gov and look up what your letter says, because this is the confusing part. And I do want people to read the book, but sometimes the IRS gives you 10 days to respond, sometimes 30 days, sometimes 45 days, sometimes 60 days, sometimes 90 days. So it's not even consistent. So some things you have to get on right away. Otherwise, you lose important appeal rights early in the process. You still might have some appeal rights later, but the less tools that you have to work with later, it's going to put a hardship on you, and you're not going to get the best advantage of the system.
Okay. And as you say here in the introduction and talk about the letter and the structure of the IRS, it seems like generally you're saying that the IRS doesn't really want to hurt anybody. They just want them to reply to the letter. But of course, there are cases where the IRS does want to hurt people and organizations when it's used as a political weapon. Is that accurate to say, you think?
I mean, I've seen that in my work. I mean, a lot of the cases, they just go along. You have a transaction with the IRS and it's taken care of. But sometimes if you get up in the face of the person that you're working with the IRS, they'll come after you. And then that's where that term, they're going to make a federal case over something. And sometimes that's just vindictive and it's unfair. And it's what the IRS does. And that's what was done when I was there. And that's what still happened. If they decide to come after you, they're going to come after you with full force. it's not fair. And the same thing with, as I talked about in the first book, it could be the color of your skin. It could be the fact that you're Jewish. It could be the fact that you're Muslim. It doesn't matter what it is. If there's something that that agent that you're working with doesn't like, they're going to come after you and exploit that. So really, really unfair.
Yeah. The political component of the Internal Revenue Service, which we've heard about Lewis Lerner and so on, and that's something that if they target you for political reasons, then there's really not much you can do about it unless all the truth comes out. But that particular thing that happened there with the Obama administration targeting these so-called conservative groups who are looking for nonprofit status, is that something that people need to be concerned about? Do you think that still happens, even though it's not really in the mainstream media nowadays?
I think especially what we're seeing now with the Clinton campaign and how things really work in Washington, that's just another example of what happens when somebody in Washington puts the word out that they want something to happen. And that's how it always happens in IRS. Everything comes from the top down, and that's the problem.
So it's inherently an unfair system, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not good, Richard. It can't leave people with confidence that they're going to be resolved properly.
That's the problem where you have people in local offices trying to enforce mandates that are coming from upstairs, you know, trying to please the boss. And it's like they don't understand that we're all in this together. I mean, all the taxpayers are in this together. You don't go picking on certain people because they have something different. It applies to poor people with IRS. It also applies to wealthy people. Wealthy people are discriminated against because IRS will say, well, we're not going to take penalties away from you because you have the money, you can pay it. And that's what we talk about in this book, what to do when the IRS is after you. They will discriminate against those people too. And it's like, if you have a right and it's under the law, you should get the benefit of getting penalties taken away or whatever. It shouldn't be based on who you are or your circumstances that they come after you. So you still see that with IRS. I still see that today when I'm representing people before the IRS.
Okay, you just had a very interesting case that you briefly told me about. Why don't you tell listeners about that if you can?
The business I just worked in?
Yeah.
Oh, it is a urgent care pediatrics practice that serves 30,000 low-income residents of a place that nobody else wants to go. It's in the inner city. Other healthcare providers don't want to go there. And there was an embezzlement that happened. And I went in with my team of people. We reclaimed the business for the owner. So that means waiting till the embezzler left and changing the locks and taking control of all the computers and imaging the computers. And I think the first day we fired 6 people and then another 4 people left, which was a good thing. And then we hired new people in. After 60 days, then we were able to hand the business back to the owner and let her have a fresh start. But embezzlements happen a lot, especially to doctors, because they generate a huge amount of money. And doctors think they have money, and they find out that somebody else is taking their money. So it was pretty exciting. And we do that kind of business where we help people get their businesses back from whoever it is, if it's from the IRS or from an embezzler. So
this person was embezzling right from, in other words, it was an employee?
Yeah, an employee who was like an office manager kind of situation.
Wow. And nobody wanted to go in there because it was a tough part of town.
Right. The employees were intimidated by this person. Yeah, I mean, nobody wanted to upset the apple cart. And that was a problem, which allowed her to stay in power for a long time. So.
Wow. And can you say which city this was?
Oh, Phoenix.
It's not just getting the letter from the IRS. Your office, RMS Consulting, does a lot more than that.
Well, the reason that they did that is the people who hired me were concerned about that they would owe some tax. And I said, no, the cool part about this kind of case is that in the end, when you figure out how much money was embezzled, the business issues a Form 1099 to the embezzler. So it doesn't matter if you get any money in restitution from the embezzler. It's like you're turning their name over to the IRS and you say, well, I'm not sure what the number is going to be. They stole $3 million or $5 million. That's all taxable income to that person. So for the next 10 years, the IRS is going to come after that alleged embezzler and say, hey, we want the tax on there. So that's kind of something that I like. It's a little justice, you know, because otherwise they'll probably not see the money.
Right. So basically they just sick the IRS on the embezzler.
Right. Yeah. But see, this is like what you were saying, Dave, about how the IRS can be used. That's the same thing like with national office. If a congressman calls up and says, well, we want this or this done, they'll do it because that's what the IRS does. They go after like a pit bull in a junkyard. You know, that's kind of what they do.
A junkyard dog.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Excellent. This book, it's a pretty big book. Yeah. It is 386 pages, including, of course, an index and preface and introduction. I'm opening it right now, and it's a good-looking book. And,
well, thanks.
Sure. And it's got 22 chapters. First one is what we talked about before, the IRS letter. In the mailbox, is in the mailbox. Chapter 2, understanding the IRS process. Chapter 3, what does the IRS do, and why do we need it? Chapter 4, how to respond to the IRS. Chapter 5, Service Center Processing. So you really go through everything here. Chapter 6, Taxpayer Assistance and IRS Walk-in Offices. 7, Examination Audit Process. 8, Collection. 9, Criminal Investigation. 10, Office of Appeals and U.S. Tax Court. 11, the Taxpayer Advocate Service. What's that about?
That's actually when the IRS doesn't do anything that they're supposed to do, where they don't resolve your case, then a taxpayer has the right to go to the taxpayer advocate and say, I sent my letter in, I sent my information in a week ago or a month ago, and the IRS hasn't resolved my case. So it's kind of a cool place to be able to go to get a faster result. And then also to get somebody else judging your case instead of just a local revenue officer or revenue agent. So it's a valuable resource if you meet their criteria, and we put their criteria in the book. So, I mean, if you're under hardship or if the IRS is not responding to you, you can file the form 911 and get your case into the advocate's office. And I always have gotten help when I've gone there.
And who are they? Are they part of the IRS?
Well, they're not part of the IRS. They're under the same funding as the IRS, but they're completely separate. Actually, a lot of them don't even seem to like the IRS at all because they've seen what the IRS can do to people. They're all completely separate. And what they do is they read the law and they apply the law, and it benefits the taxpayers. So it's a really good operation.
Wow. I don't think a lot of people know about that. Chapter 12, how to prepare a collection, financial statement. 13, the truth about offers and compromise. 14, how to get tax penalties and interest reduced or eliminated. 15, identity fraud, refund fraud, and other IRS-related fraud. 16, tax planning for your life from birth to death. 17, church and charity work, what you need to know before you volunteer. 18, what do you really pay in taxes? 19, are income taxes really legal? And we talked about this before, but there are a lot of people out there, Richard, as you know, who believe that the IRS is not legitimate, that the 16th Amendment was never ratified. What do you have to say about that?
I believe that they have a basis to say that. But what I prefer to do is protect myself and protect the people I'm working for, the tax clients. So it's like figure out what the IRS wants and then turn it to your advantage. So that's why I say constitutional arguments I would avoid unless you're part of a class of people that's protesting them. I say take care of your own self first.
But is there some truth in that claim that the IRS is illegitimate?
A lot of people see where the Supreme Court had said that the IRS was not, because the income tax law was repealed and upheld by the Supreme Court. So I've read the same things as they've read, and I'd say there could be something there, but I'm not going to say for sure. But yeah, I mean, it looks like in the early 1900s, it might be credible, but not for me to say.
Okay, and that's in the book where you do talk about that particular case, and if people want to familiarize themselves with it, then go for it. But right now, as far as you're concerned and as far as people you are affiliated with are concerned, the IRS has a right to exist.
I kind of look at the big picture because there's some people who don't want to ever pay any taxes at all. So, I mean, I support the military and the veterans and, you know, all the things that we need from society. So the money's got to come from somewhere. I don't know if the income tax is the best place for it to come from because we're a really rich nation. And I've gotten this from my taxpayers over the years. Everybody wants to pay their fair share and contribute to society. But then the rub is, what is your fair share? And that's a big question. You know, what is your fair share? Because in the last month, I got interviewed by the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post about Donald Trump's tax circumstances. And this is before his tax return information came out. And I said he probably doesn't owe any taxes because real estate developers rarely or never pay taxes until, you know, years down the road. And so he got an advantage, and it's perfectly legal. I don't know if it's ethically right to never pay any taxes, but it's legal. So you can't blame anything on him. It was Congress who made the laws. And that's basically what I'm saying. If you cover yourself and make sure what you're doing is legal, then you're going to be okay.
And he has said that over and over again, that it's Clinton's fault. If she wanted to change it, she should have. But did he release his tax returns?
No, he didn't. It was a leak from somebody in the New York Times, a 1999 tax return. But whether it was real or not, it's feasible that he would not owe any taxes. Because, I mean, I've seen a lot of real estate developers, probably 100 over the years, and they just literally never pay any taxes until the project is sold. And that could be 30 years down the road. So.
Right. And maybe that's one of the reasons they're getting into real estate, because they don't have to
pay. Oh, yeah. Why pay taxes when you don't have to?
Right. I do and did, and it sucks.
Right.
But like you said, we do need certain things that the government is providing us with. So
right.
If nobody paid taxes, then we wouldn't have these things. But go ahead.
Right. Sorry. The big thing that we talk about in the book is how can you get the maximum advantage for you? So even if you're a wage earner, what I say, and my co-authors were Laurie Goff and William Deacon, and they're both revenue agents. So those are the people that would have done audits. And the idea is to have a side business where you're selling something, making something, and doing something that somebody's going to pay you for. And then the government, all of a sudden, once you have a business, they allow you to write off a lot of your expenses. I mean, as long as you went in with a profit motivation, that's why you're winning the business, to make money, the government will allow your expenses. And the cool part is you can lose money the first or second or third year, and then whatever money you lose on paper over there actually offsets the income that you have, the wage earner, the W-2 income. This is how wealthy people get more than they have, because they use the tax laws to their advantage. So even in a small way, we always recommend having a self-employed business, Schedule C business, because the bottom line, it'll help you out. And then if it doesn't work out, you can close the business and you can start a new business.
Chapter 20, IRS Survival Strategies. Chapter 21, How to Find a Qualified Tax Professional and Avoid Preparer Fraud. There's one more chapter and then the appendix and index. Preparer fraud, is that common?
Yeah, actually, a lot of times you'll see on TV or hear them on the radio telling them that they can resolve your tax issues, and they may or may not be able to, but they charge you a huge amount of money. And that was one of the reasons that we got together and formed this company, because we charge a lot less for the same idea. And what happened was, right before I retired, I never worked cases under $100,000, but I was assigned a case for $17,000. And I went out to the taxpayer's house, and I knocked on the door, and he was already ill, but his blood sugar dropped, so he was getting ready to collapse on the floor. I get him in a chair, I go to the kitchen, get him some orange juice and crackers, and he only owed $17,000. And he said, I paid this company so you would never be out here. I'm so terrified of the IRS. And I said, how much did you pay him? And he said, I paid him $7,000. In a case like that, I said, well, they went into bankruptcy, so they can't represent you. But I talked to him for about 10 minutes, and we made an installment agreement. And actually, in my practice now, I don't even charge people if they owe under $25,000. I tell them what to do, and a big part of it is in the book. I tell you what to do and the rights that you have. Actually, a lot of people can negotiate if it's under $50,000. So it just kind of burns me when I watch TV and see these commercials where they say, settle with the IRS for 50 cents on a dollar, or a nickel on a dollar. And that can happen. It's extremely rare. And a lot of the people have severe life-threatening illness, or they're really old, or some other circumstance. Because the IRS is not giving anything away, and they're not planning to give anything away. Congress actually wanted them to be more open with the offering compromises, but IRS is really conservative. So, like I said, they're not giving anything away, and doing things in a reasonable fashion is also not something that they're known for. So these are just some of the ideas in the book, and that's what our motivation is to help people that owe taxes or are being audited, to give them the tools that they need to stand up to the IRS and say, wait a minute, I have this right. I want this to happen. You know, how do you make it happen? And then give them the actual tools. Like you said, it's like a manual of how to make the IRS work for you.
This particular guy here, he got conned by this company, you're saying. And,
right.
And they went bankrupt. And so he was out the $7,000.
Right, yeah. In our company, for the same thing, usually it would be $1,500. It depends how complicated your case is. But like I said, on a $17,000 case, we don't even accept those. So if you owe over $50,000, it would be $1,500. Usually if you owe $1,000,000, it would only go up to $5,000. That's what our fee is, and it covers everything. So it is a little easier for us because we've been doing this for a long time. All of the people are retirees. We enjoy it. We enjoy helping people.
Yeah. So, I know that from the first time we spoke, from reading your first book, and it's clear that you really enjoy helping people, and that that's something very important, because so many people are like that. There aren't too many people out there who really want to help people and not screw them. And you just, you just want to help them out, which is a great thing. I mean, I don't know if you have these statistics, but how many people actually owe these huge amounts of numbers to the IRS? 50,000, 100,000, a million? Is that like an anomaly, or are there people who actually owe that kind of money?
Right now, I have 14 clients who owe over $1 million. And that's just here in Tucson, which is not a major center of the world. I believe there's about 2.5 million people that owe the IRS money, delinquent taxes.
Wow, that's a huge... I never would have imagined that. Just your firm, you have, what did you say, 14 people who owe over $1 million.
Yeah. And the funny part of it is that one person owes $3.7 million. So the other day, I received an audit letter from him, and then I have to respond. He said, what are we going to do? And I said... Well, we're not going to do anything. They could do the audit and they could assess whatever they want. It doesn't matter. You're not able to pay the $3.7 million. Who cares if they add another $500,000 on there? It's kind of comical at that point. Wow. Instead of the IRS looking to make a deal, this is a person who had a lot of assets, had a company, and it's all gone. So you would think that they would make a deal, and the IRS doesn't want to make a deal. So
sometimes they don't want a deal, and maybe when you get up that big, like this person is, that there are some political ramifications here, maybe?
This guy that I'm talking about, he's already older, he's lost everything, and a normal business would say, oh, we're never going to see anything out of you, maybe we'll just close it and write it off. And the IRS, they don't think like a normal business, and they don't think about being reasonable. That's the problem. They're coming at it from a different perspective, which really isn't in the best interest of the government. I mean, why waste time on somebody who already owes that much money if they don't have anything? He's never going to have enough money to pay it back. So leave him alone. That's where I come from.
Right. But they don't. And that's what you're there for. Chapter 22, what to do about the IRS situation. Then you got the appendix and the index. And like I said, it's a great book. And people are fortunate to have you out there, Richard, to help them out. I like to ask this question to authors when I interview them, Richard, is folks, normal folks like us, average folks who don't have unlimited access to capital like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, because they do, obviously they've turned their government service into a cash cow, and maybe they've done it legally, but that's not why you would think people would get involved with government service to make a lot of money, which they've done with this Clinton Foundation. But for your average person who doesn't have money coming out of every orifice of their body, why should somebody then go ahead and plunk down the money for this book?
Because it could help out a whole group of people. I mean, in every gathering, in every family, there's always one or two people that have IRS problems, either in the recent past or current problems. We used many pages just talking about the letters, because even though I'm an enrolled agent, a tax professional, it's still really hard to figure out which letter you have and what the implications of that letter are and what rights come along with it. And that's me. You know, 36 years I've been doing this, and I still have trouble following the letters because they keep changing them. And they keep changing the rights and what's listed there. So this is kind of, like you said, a manual. You don't need to read the whole book. You read the part of the book that really applies to you, and then there'll be other people it applies to. Because in most cases, you can represent yourself before collection. If you owe, say, under $50,000, you don't need to hire somebody like me. This book tells you what to do. And for simple audits, it also tells you what to do. And the first thing is, keep your mouth shut. So don't offer them anything that they didn't specifically ask for. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but it's a really big deal, because a lot of people will get into an audit situation and they'll start volunteering things. And what was a simple, easy audit all of a sudden becomes a big audit because you've told too much about your life and your business. And then the IRS comes after that. So that's really a good qualifier for why this book would be helpful. And really what it does, it takes the fear away. And that's what we were trying to do, is give people hope and take the fear away. Because one thing that people don't know, which we spend a lot of time on in the book, if you do owe taxes after 10 years, those taxes go away. The statute expires and they go away. And also the other part that's really needed to know in the book, say you haven't filed in 10 years. You don't file the last 10 years. You file the last 6 years, because that's what the IRS is required to get from you, the last 6 years. So that alone can save you tens of thousands of dollars in penalties and interest. So it's the little stories like that. Also, another one would be, income taxes are dischargeable in bankruptcy after 3 years. So, I mean, those three things right there would save you whatever it is that the book costs. You'll save the money like right away, right up front. And then the book has enough information that should be good for the next 3 or 4 years just because we captured it the way it is right now. So you got a perfect picture of the IRS.
Excellent. What's the best way for folks to get in touch with you?
Well, you could just Google my name. So Richard Schickel, S-C-H-I-C-K-E-L. And there's two of us. There's my cousin, who's the movie critic. And then there's me, the tax guy. And it's called RMS Tax Consulting in Tucson, Arizona. And the phone number is 520-668-3243. That's my cell phone. I take the calls directly. I try to keep overhead down. So we all try to get our own work done and help people. And this is why we wrote the book. We thought we could help a larger number of people than just sitting in the office waiting for people to come. I was going to tell you, Dave, with my first book, I've sold about 3,200 copies of the first book. And the funniest part of that is you can track these things on the internet. I've sold 320 books internationally, Great Britain, Chile, China, Russia, Australia. And it was very confusing at first. I thought, why are these people buying this book about the American tax system? And it's because last December, Congress said that they were looking into taking your passport away if you had a passport but you hadn't filed and paid taxes, which happens to a lot of people apparently. So it was just kind of an odd thing. I mean, it's a good thing they're getting the information. It was just unexpected, and I thought that you'd find that interesting and your audience would find it interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. What's also interesting, what you said, your cousin, same name except I guess a different middle name.
He's from Milwaukee and I'm from Chicago.
Okay. Yeah. Is he well known in the circles?
Yeah, he knows a lot of people. I know his book on Clint Eastwood was very popular. He lives in Hollywood and he knows all the people he's writing about.
People are calling him up to help with their taxes.
A lot of people try to friend me on the internet thinking that I'm like him. His Hollywood writer, and I'm not.
So. Oh, that's good stuff. Richard, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to listeners. Richard, it's always a great pleasure for me to speak with you, and what an amazing career you've had, and so glad you're out there helping folks the way you are, Richard. So thanks again for coming on and talking about your new book.
And thanks to you, Dave, and to your newspaper, which has just been instrumental in getting the news out to the world and for getting news out that maybe the government doesn't want us to even know. I'm so thankful for the interview and what you guys do. I mean, all of the reporters and everyone, it's a big thing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard.